My name's Mark Schwartz. I'm the program manager for the Infancy Program, which is part of Optometry Cares, the AOA Foundation. I have over 10 years in pediatric public health programs with chronic illnesses and now with optometry and providing vision care for the next generation of Americans. I have no disclosures. So this is Infancy. It's a national public health program. We've been in existence for a little over 5 years. We currently have over 8,700 optometrists, one of which our chair, Dr. Steele, is in the back of the room. And we were started as a challenge from President Jimmy Carter. His grandchildren suffered from a visual occurrence, and he thought that it would be mandatory that everyone, every infant in this country, receive an eye exam at no cost to detect any vision issues that may surround the child. In 2009, we engaged in a CDC-funded project in these 8 states. I'm a Southerner, so spending the month of January in Wisconsin was not appealing, but the month of August in Louisiana was. We utilized both mobile clinics, social networking, traditional advertising, and then these partnerships with maternal and child health agencies. Just a graphical representation of the Infancy Project, the two big pillars have the mobile clinic participation in Louisiana and West Virginia. The other states did not have a mobile clinic but utilized the advertising and other pieces of providing in-office appointments as well as utilizing non-traditional office visits as well. Excuse me, you can see the graphical depiction of the influence of the advertising of the participation in these projects. 124 infants were reported for the first week in West Virginia as compared to 3 exams done the previous year. That's with a mobile clinic. Incidences without mobile clinic in Des Moines, Iowa, 2 exams reported compared to 32. So obviously there's an increase in bulk up of advertising and other means to do this. I want to talk briefly about the cause for concern rate and what a cause for concern may be: a failed examination, a failed component in visual acuity, ocular motility, binocularity, refractive status, and ocular health. The thing that defines the Infancy Program is we actually do a no-cost, complete, comprehensive eye exam, and we also dilate the eyes. So pre-2007, data suggested 1 in 14. 2009, in our CDC project, 1 in 6 infants had a failed exam. In 2010, the current data displays about 1 in 7 detecting some sort of failed component to the examination. We saw over 1,000 infants, 180 of them had a cause for concern. Premature and minority infants at a higher risk, and the socioeconomic data I'll talk about in just a second. Specifically speaking about prematurity, roughly 14% of the infants were born premature that we saw. 1 in 5 of those had a failed examination. The modeling suggests that for every week born prior to 36 weeks of gestation is what we assumed, the rate of cause for concern increases by 10% for every week prior to that. Excuse me, this mountain air is troubling me. The median income, $36,000, the range of $500,000 to $325,000, thank you very much. Of all the children receiving an exam below $36,000, the cause for concern rate was 1 in 4. Above $36,000, it was 1 in 6. The infants below the 34,000 were 2 times as likely to have a issue in visual acuity, ocular motility, binocularity, and significantly related to the household income. Our margin of error was plus or minus 2% done by our biostatistician at Washington University in St. Louis, and our numbers were in line with the census data. As compared just to the federal poverty guidelines, 2-person families below the 14,500, the cause for concern and failure rate was 1 in 3.6, and above 18,000 or below 18,310 was 1 in 4.3. Those then disclosing, these were just taking the basic federal poverty guidelines, then those in, families disclosing their family income, 1 parent above the 14,500, the rate was 1 in 3.8, and 2 parents was 1 in 4.9. I want to talk just briefly about the geographic data. This is sort of biased by the mobile clinic, but on average, individuals, families travel 13 miles, excuse me, or 17 minutes to receive the infancy exam. The range of travel was 1 to 90 miles, and the time was 1 to 3 hours for the examination. Of course, some of the urban areas like Chicago, Seattle was cut down, but of those families reporting traveling longer than the average, all had some sort of failed examination. The previous speaker mentioned access to care issues, whether they're free or costing. Those most in need aren't receiving care, and of those who failed the exam traveling the great distances, they referred to pediatric specialists, which may compound the problem of not receiving care in their local area, of then having to travel for further care. This is a profile of two of the cities that we were at. The one on the left is a mobile clinic location. Their travel time was 12 miles or 15 minutes. Their cause of concern rate was 1 in 5, and a retinoblastoma, essentially eye cancer, the seventh leading pediatric cancer, was found in this location. In a non-mobile clinic site, a large metropolitan area, you can see the disparity between the household income, travel time a little bit less, but still a retinoblastoma was found in that area as well. So what are the implications for community planning? Deconstructing these barriers and access to care, certainly these false reassurances that infant vision and vision as a whole is approved and is going well. This medical home concept, we know that the non-traditional medical providers, primary health care providers, accredited health care providers, in this case optometry, are doing these services, and we're linking with pediatricians all across the country. However, the availability of care, regardless of if a pediatrician or nurse practitioner or primary health care provider is available, these situations are still presenting themselves all across the country, and providing care to these infants in these most need situations is a great priority. These systemic approaches, I talked briefly about partnering with maternal and child health agencies, but long-term sustainable care, building the systems, building coalitions to help contain the message and carry out the message in a non-optometric factor is of great importance. So if someone else endorses this program, if a state government, maternal and child health, the governor, whatever it is, and they carry out this message, somehow there's more reputation and more manner to which people take action as a part of these activities. And then, as the previous speaker mentioned, providing services with faith-based initiatives and non-traditional methods, going on the road, community health centers, and venues that are recognizable to the population, whether these be particularly in these low-income areas, whether they be traditional safety net organizations, partnering with those organizations to help carry out this message not only of optometry and this infancy program, but other non-traditional healthcare avenues certainly resonates well with the public and certainly resonates to the fact where individuals and their families will take action regarding these services. So how do we deconstruct these barriers, and how do we provide the care for these infants and these families most in need? Education awareness and the systemic building that I just mentioned, but that is not enough. You have to take the next step of having these trusted resources in each community who are going out to spread the word of the message to these mothers, families who are at greatest length, and then providing these services, these preventative health promotion services for the next generations of Americans is absolutely important. Healthcare reform will be all about prevention and programs like infancy that are quickly being recognized by individuals within the federal government may be trendy right now, but may become more mainstay as health reform is integrated. And then there's inclusion of primary health care services in most at-risk populations. Regardless of the income, regardless of the location, the geography, using these free services, these no-cost services, provide an opportunity not only to increase prevention, which may lead to decreased health expenditures across the lifespan, but how do these non-traditional health care providers become even more recognized, and infancy is one type of activity in which that recognition is starting to take place. So these are a few of our infants that we've seen all across the country. I want to take a quick moment to mention that we're still undergoing some federal funding. We were in South Carolina earlier this year, and the rating cause of concern is still 1 in 7. And the mothers out there, and I use mother as a generic term, but the parents out there, recognize that this is a worthy program. and the pediatricians, there seems to be some sort of integration, because as a result of our Louisiana experience with this, a pediatrician in Rayville, Louisiana, referred a three-day-old baby to the optometrist because he or she couldn't identify a red reflex. When they came into the optometrist, just 3 days of age, bilateral congenital cataracts were found. So this program is doing great merit and great deed across the country. I'll be happy as well to talk to you about contacts and finding out more about the infancy program in your area. And a quick acknowledgement that we were funded by the CDC back in 2009 for this project. So I thank you for your time and any questions as well. Let me just breathe for clearing my throat.
Well, we held questions to the end, so if any of you all have questions for any of our presenters, we would be glad to entertain those questions. Yes.
So for HEAC, BMI measurements were taken not specifically with patients in clinics, with children in clinics, but they were taken in 5th, 7th, and 9th graders that were in the school districts in the HEAC sites, and they were measured several times over the course of HEAC. So, and I don't know, maybe you're more familiar with the results of this, Bill, but I don't know if they're were any significant changes in BMI or if they remain the same. I have a feeling that there weren't significant changes in BMI during the several years that the intervention took place. And, you know, the other thing is I think realistically getting to the point where the BMI changes are seen because of these environmental interventions or even changes in clinical practices could be a much longer process.
So 2 years is the long
time. Right, it was 3 years, yeah.
Sorry, I didn't know.
Yeah. So it was the phase one was 3 years, so, yeah.
Yes?
Mine is more of a statement. My focus is health education and health prevention, and my first, I was gonna just address it to Ms. Boyle, but it fits for all three of you, that prevention, obviously, how do we shift our energies from primary care, clinical care, to prevention when our primary needs keep increasing because we don't have prevention? So it's the vicious cycle. And I wonder if there's a focus somewhere that clinical training can have more prevention training in it, you know, for the medical students and the optometrists and all the other clinicians. You know, because your training needs are what we do in health education about ways to prevent, effective prevention strategies and so forth. So just a statement about one step forward, two steps back.
Well, I can mention that at least in the state of Oklahoma in our medical school, they now have added a prevention curriculum, and there is an option for medical students to have a public health experience. So I think that's becoming recognized for primary care providers. But I think also, as Audrey mentioned, if communities start using the MAP process for assessment and develop strategic plans, and we're working with partners in the community, I think everybody was talking about that. If your medical providers are working with the public health providers, then hopefully you're able to address some of those things through those partnerships.
If I can just say one thing, there are so many of these, what I deem as trusted resources, pediatric stakeholders in my situation, I don't know about, that are getting their message out on a daily basis, whether they're going door to door and passing out flyers. And I think the attention that's being gained by those resources is starting to take notice. But I think it only takes notice in progressive communities. Lots of these communities across the country, and going from Chicago to Rayville, Louisiana, it's not a top priority due to fiscal considerations. But you know, there are so many conditions of obesity and vision and all these that have an impact economically on a community that provide this vicious cycle as you were talking about, and those progressive communities that are recognizing this, you kind of see a better standard of living, a better health assessment, a better health status overall. And then the other point, not a lot of docs in the traditional sense have an interest in public health because it doesn't contribute to their bottom line. And that becomes even more problematic where their bottom line can be significantly impacted by prevention.
One of Ms. Boyle's findings was that they don't get reimbursement for prevention services. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's just a few words they say to a parent that could be prevention, but they're not seeing it as a bottom line measure.
Absolutely.
And that was, you know, when the PEAC first started, that was a major barrier for healthcare providers and was quite discussed in all of the sites around how to make this a priority for healthcare providers because of the time factor during these very brief clinical visits as well as the reimbursement piece. But I think because a lot of the providers did receive that training, they were able to prioritize it and it did start to change some clinical practices, so.
Yes?
I think that you mentioned that 58% of the providers did not attend the training. So did you guys think of any ways to get that number to increase?
And those were trainings within the past year. So there was a possibility that early on in HEAC they had received some type of advocacy training and that just wasn't captured, excuse me, in the endpoint data. Because in the beginning they did receive, for a lot of the sites, they did receive training on the obesity prevention messages in their clinical practices. And some of the, depending on what the interventions were chosen by the site, some of the providers did receive advocacy trainings as well. But I think that's a real area for growth in terms of, especially in terms of then once the providers even have been trained, how to connect them with easy advocacy opportunities, so ways that they can, you know, use what they've learned in a training, and then become advocates in an easy way, which maximizes their time as well as their knowledge as providers.
One of the interesting findings was that that follow-up, the providers indicated greater resistance or less support by employers to engage in this kind of work. Can you speculate as to why that is?
I was thinking about this, and I thought maybe there was more of an interest in becoming advocates, in doing advocacy work, so that's why, for those of you who weren't here when I did my presentation, one of the barriers to engaging in advocacy was a lack of support from the workplace, and this was a higher number of respondents said this was a barrier at endpoint versus at baseline. And I was wondering if more providers were actually interested in being advocates at endpoint, and so then this became a greater barrier. But I really don't know, I have to say. That's my speculation.
Right, so I agree with you. I think it's increased awareness.
Exactly.
Since at baseline, so few, it's less than 10% of providers were engaged in advocacy.
Right.
And then it was double that at follow-up. And so that meant there were twice as many who could be now aware that employers were not exactly enthusiastic about their providers going out to the community and raising a ruckus about obesity.
Right.
I think the other thing to consider, is we're essentially asking providers to go out of their comfort zone for what they were trained to do.
Absolutely.
And the advocacy component, what we do with infancy is empower them to take action on the local level. So, you know, theoretically we ask, if you were going to advertise your practice in infancy, or if you have any patients that are in the media, that are part of state legislature, that are in city government, what is the bad point of talking to them about this project? I've never thought about that. I've never considered that. I've never, you know, I don't want to cross that threshold of patient-provider, but once that I do, look at all the benefit that comes out of that. So I think we're slowly starting to see that, particularly in our program, and I don't know, speaking for the others.
To enlarge on that point, sorry to dominate the discussion here. The American Academy of Pediatrics now, in the case of obesity anyway, now says the pediatrician has a responsibility to go out in the community. It's not enough to limit their obesity prevention activities to what they're doing in the clinic. And so you speak of comfort zone. Now an official body is saying to its members, you can't remain comfortable in the clinic. You're not doing your full job unless you get out to the school board meetings, go to city council meetings, become more active in the community, because otherwise the obesity epidemic is not going to disappear. So now it's our task as public health interveners to provide the training, provide the bridge, to take them out of this very comforting, authoritative milieu called the clinic, and take them into the community where, you know, they have less control over how people respond to their message.
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent segue into something I'm wondering about. I'm here as a guest, and forgive me if I don't follow everything, but for the last speaker, if you're looking for trusted resources in the community, and if typically when you're trying to go out into the community, you, a medical provider, you're going into a school board or a school, something like that. How do you get at getting into the school, the preschool age population? Who are the partners that you look for?
Daycare workers, daycare centers, anyone that has the pediatricians, the public health department, the WIC offices, a SLU. There would be more trusted resources out there than you think. Faith-based initiatives, particularly in the states that we were at, are huge, impactful, trusted resources. A church minister, a pastor, has the power to change a community, probably in some communities better than the mayor does, in my opinion. So when you look at that, these trusted resources, it is highly subjective to each community that you go into, but they're kind of uniform in which there are outreach workers, of birth to three programs, of Healthy Start programs, of all of these initiatives that may not look at specifically 0 to 1 year, but 1 to 3 years of age, but can say by the time you get to 1 year of age, you should have had X, Y, and Z done. So it's a complementary arrangement that you can essentially say, in order to get to the end point, you've got to have a healthy start and a healthy foundation. And so that's kind of using those resources to become the stakeholders to advocate for the program, although it may not be in their targeted age demographic.
It seems like you could get retail partnerships, say, for baby supply stores and baby wear and things like that.
You know, we partner with Johnson & Johnson, and so Baby Center, you know, the whole social media, social networking, BabyCenter, baby.com, even parent groups that start out in HA and breastfeeding classes and mamas classes, there are some initiatives that we're doing with family planners now to talk about what's going on. I don't know how many of you all know about a program called Text for Baby that provides health messaging, perinatal, and then up to the first year of life. That seems to resonate well. People want to be provided with the information to take action, but when they go ask their pediatrician, and not to pick on pediatricians, that's what I'm here to do. That's my job here, but yet they don't want to provide those services. So we hear very often the self-investigation of parents going out and finding these types of programs, one, because they can't afford to go to the pediatrician or wherever. They go to the community health center or the public health department, and that creates this foundation of support and these trusted resources.
Any other questions?
I have a question for Dr. Burnett. Some of your point estimates are concerning already, but I'm wondering how much they were affected by the non-response rate, which was rather high. Mm-hmm. We know that more females than males responded, so that's some indication. To what degree did you investigate the systematic bias introduced by the differential non-response, particularly for the low-income folks?
Right. We're actually working with a team to perform another community health needs assessment to try to target maybe that group or the groups less likely to respond this first time. This was actually a second phase from a similar assessment done in 2000. So it's kind of an ongoing process that we'll continue to do. But yeah, it's interesting with the lack of response rate and why those reasons are. And of course, probably we're suspecting the heavy population of females in that area in general, or whether or not if it was a single family, you know, single female household or what have you. So we're trying to look at those factors currently for in order to target our next assessment population. Mm-hmm. Does that cover your question? Or?
Well, given if you have census data and you've got mm-hmm. your profiles, have you done a comparison to see how much of a difference there is, for instance, in the proportion who are single parent families compared to what you would expect for a rural population based on the U.S. Census data?
Right, we're looking at that currently in order with our team in order to address the next assessment issues because they are there and they need to be addressed certainly before we conduct the next assessment. Mm-hmm, definitely. Excellent question, though.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, thank you all for coming this morning, and we hope you all enjoy your day. Lots of wonderful opportunities for presentations.